This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Hello, my name is Charles Ryan. I'm a professor of medicine and urology at the University of California, San Francisco. And tonight we're going to talk about advanced prostate cancer, which is part of our series on genitourinary cancers. Prostate cancer is a very well-known disease. It's a very common disease, and it doesn't seem like a month goes by where you're not hearing about some business leader, politician, or entertainment figure who's been diagnosed with the disease. So it's something that we're all exposed to and know many people who are afflicted by it. Less known are the fact that a number of patients do, in fact, die of prostate cancer. All of the men I showed you on the previous slide were treated and are well today. And here's a picture of some well-known figures throughout world history in the last few decades who have died from this disease. And as a medical oncologist, I'm going to walk you through the situations that patients face when they have advanced prostate cancer and how it differs maybe from those patients who are cured from the disease as it has become with surgery or radiation, as it becomes a very different set of medical issues for those patients. And so I'm going to start with a very provocative statement, and I'm going to say it's not about the prostate. Because actually, for advanced prostate cancer, when we talk about it, what I'm going to talk to you about tonight is that prostate cancer that is advanced, and when I refer to it, I'm referring to a systemic condition. Mostly what I'm talking about is a systemic condition that afflicts the bones of men who have had disease in the prostate, but that disease has spread outside of the prostate, mostly to the bones, sometimes to other organs, but we're really talking about a systemic medical condition. And so I'm not going to talk to you tonight about surgery. I'm not going to talk to you tonight much about radiation therapy. Both of those are very important treatments for this disease, but those really focus on the prostate gland. That is early prostate cancer, and that's going to be covered in another lecture in this series by my colleague, Dr. Cooperberg, and he's going to talk about the issues such as PSA screening, identification of which patients should have surgery, which patients should have radiation, and those types of issues. So I'm going to focus on the systemic condition. And I don't want to start on a down note, but I really want to talk about why it is that some men who are diagnosed with this disease go on to die of this disease and what we're doing to try to slow that process down and hopefully one day eliminate that process from occurring. Prostate cancer becomes lethal with the confluence of two events. Event number one is the progression of the disease despite standard hormonal therapy or despite a low testosterone level. And in the graph, I show that the white line is a testosterone level that has been suppressed through castration therapy. And I hate to use that term, but it's a term that implies that we've lowered the testosterone to a very low level. The red line shows the decline in the PSA and, by extension, the extent of the disease. And all is well and good for patients when the disease is well controlled during this time of sensitivity to hormonal therapy. It's really when a patient's clinical experience goes to the point where the testosterone has been suppressed, but the PSA begins to rise and the disease begins to progress. And the medical term for this now and the term that's in the literature is castration-resistant prostate cancer. It implies progression of the disease despite a testosterone level below 50 nanograms per deciliter. And then the other event that occurs that makes this cancer lethal is when the disease spreads to bone. Okay, and again, that is the most common site of the disease and the site where patients really begin to experience the most suffering from this disease. So I'm going to talk to you about treatments that we have that are in existence that can slow that process down, in many cases reverse that, but first we need to focus a little bit on the biology of the underlying condition. Bone metastases. On your right, you see a sodium fluoride PET scan of a patient with metastatic prostate cancer, and it looks like a pretty scary picture. What you may not know is that this patient actually may feel 100% fine at this point. This looks like it would be something where, with the spine being involved with the cancer and even parts in the skull being involved, that this patient would have a lot of suffering going on. And that may be the case, but it isn't always the case. And I'm always surprised when patients come into my clinic and we do a scan like this, and we do a scan and we see a picture like this, and the patient looks absolutely fine. But what's going on in those bone metastasis is a complicated series of factors where the cancer is existing in a microenvironment where it's really creating destruction of bone on one hand to make room for the tumor to grow, but then growth of the bone on the other hand in what we call osteoblastic lesions. And it's really that combination of bone destruction and the excessive production of bone laid down as a matrix for which on which the cancer can grow that creates these lesions that show up on these scans and can ultimately lead to two things. One is complications in the bone, such as fractures and pain. And then the other factor, which is shown a little bit down here in the lower slide, it's not easy to make up much sense from that slide, but that's a bone marrow that is packed with prostate cancer. And so over time, if the cancer that has spread to the bone is capable of overtaking that marrow, it can cause all kinds of problems ranging from fatigue to anemia and eventually can be lethal to the patient. So I've started out, I agree that I start out on a little bit of a down note by saying this disease can be lethal, and that's the condition that we face in treating advanced prostate cancer. But I'm going to back up and I'm going to talk first about how long this process can actually be. So when we think about prostate cancer, we think about that first picture with Arnold Palmer, Robert De Niro, and all these men who were diagnosed with it. Those are the men who fall into this roughly 230,000 cases per year of men who are diagnosed with prostate cancer. And yes, that's one in six American men will be diagnosed at some point with this disease. The vast majority of those men will undergo treatment of some kind, radiation or surgery, and fortunately, the vast majority of those patients will be cured of their disease. And there's an ongoing conversation about whether or not some of those patients need any treatment at all. And again, that'll be covered in a different topic. But then what may happen in about 30% or so of patients who are treated with surgery or radiation is they may experience a relapse of the disease, and the first relapse that patients would experience would be a rising PSA. And we think about 50,000 men every year in the United States experience this problem. Now, these patients live a long time because a rising PSA is not the same thing as having metastasis or having that castration-resistant problem or being anywhere near dying from the disease. And so currently we estimate that there are somewhere between 2 and 2.5 million men in the United States who have had treatment for prostate cancer, whose PSA is rising, and so in a way have experienced a relapse of this disease. Many of them don't know that this has occurred. Many of them who do know that this has occurred are not getting any treatment for it, and even those who are getting treatment for it generally have a good quality of life and can expect a fairly long survival and good prognosis with that condition. It's really to when the disease becomes metastatic, as I indicated before, and when that castration resistance or that hormone resistance occurs later on in life. So now I'm going to focus on hormone therapy, because this really begins to be the foundation for the systemic treatment of this systemic disease. I'm going to use the terms interchangeably of androgen deprivation therapy, which, as the name implies, means that we're bringing down testosterone levels. But really, in clinic or in other circles, we would use the term hormonal therapy. So let's talk for a minute about what that actually is. This is a very simplified picture of the endocrine system as it pertains to testosterone production in a human. The stimulus for testosterone production begins in the brain. The brain releases a hormone called LHRH, which stands for luteinizing hormone releasing hormone. And that's a releasing hormone, meaning it goes to the pituitary gland, and it tells the pituitary gland to release another hormone. It's a cascade of events. The pituitary gland then releases luteinizing hormone, here shortened as LH. And LH and FSH, its partner, stimulate the testicles to produce testosterone. Testosterone then circulates in the blood as a hormone and is eventually converted into dihydrotestosterone, where it can bind to the androgen receptor in prostate cancer cells. And I'll show you another picture on that later, but it's really that critical event of the androgen or the testosterone binding to the testosterone or the androgen receptor in that cancer cell that leads to PSA production, metastasis or spread of the cancer, and growth of the tumor. And this process occurs whether the tumor is in the prostate, it occurs whether the tumor is in the bone, the lymph nodes, or the liver. It's the same process. It began in the prostate and has spread to these other parts of the body. I should also say that the androgen receptor is not something that is only found in prostate cancer. It's found throughout the body, in fact. In fact, our muscles, our brain, and many other organs have androgen receptors, and that's one of the reasons why testosterone has so many effects, both good and bad, in humans, both in development as well as in aging, and that's another very fascinating topic. I'm going to start, and this is this picture that I showed you before, which is PSA comes from the prostate cancer. PSA is in many ways a marker of androgen or testosterone stimulation of the tumor, but PSA does not tell the whole story. And in fact, I'm going to use PSA a lot, talk about PSA a lot in this talk, but in fact, this is a picture from a colleague at the University of Washington where they took a bone metastasis from a patient with prostate cancer, and they did an immunohistochemistry stain looking for PSA in the tumor. And what you see here is in that upper right part where it's brown, that's PSA present in these tumor cells. And in the lower left part, those are still prostate cancer cells, but they don't make any PSA. So one of the things we're learning as time goes on is that PSA is both a good indicator of a recurrence, as I mentioned, with those 50,000 men who experience a recurrence every year in the form of a rising PSA, but it's not a 100% surrogate for the disease itself. Moving on to talk a little bit about hormone therapy. Hormonal therapy, as we currently know it, began in the 1940s, and this is the cover of the Archives of Surgery, 1941, a landmark paper in the history of urology, a history of medicine, a history of oncology, where Charles Huggins and Clarence Hodges, who were working together at the University of Chicago, did a series of studies on prostate cancer where they actually did physical or surgical castration in animals first and then in humans on advanced prostate cancer and showed that patients, their suffering was alleviated. These were all patients who had bony metastases or urinary obstruction, other problems like that. And that really began the current era of, I should say the initial era of androgen deprivation therapy or of hormonal therapy. What's very interesting is that hormonal therapy changed very, very little for about 60 years. And it was in the last part of the early part of the last decade that we began to experiment with some newer hormonal agents that are now standards of care and are delivered to men across the world. And so I'll talk about those as we move on. So one of the big issues about hormonal therapy is when should we start it, and what are the side effects? And so when I sit down with a patient and I'm contemplating initiating hormonal therapy, I think about, you know, what's his risk for having a real problem from this disease? What's his risk for developing bone mets? What's his risk for becoming one of these individuals in whom prostate cancer could become a life-threatening problem? What are his other medical problems? The term we use for that is comorbidities. And what else can I offer this patient that might be something that we could that could delay the onset of androgen deprivation therapy? So let's talk about that and what and why I might, for example, take one of these men who's had surgery or radiation and then has a rising PSA and why I might think about starting him on hormonal therapy. Well, the truth is there's a wide range of prognoses that can occur in a patient with a rising PSA after definitive local therapy. Some men may come in very worried about their PSA, and their PSA might be 0.1 or 0.2, and I go back and I look and I see how quickly it's been rising, and I note that it's taken 3 years for it to get to 0.2 from 0.1. Well, that's a very slowly rising PSA. There might be other patients who come in and their PSA is 0.4, let's say, but let's say a month previous they had one done and it was 0.2, so maybe their PSA is doubling every month, which would be a very rapid rise. And in fact, these are survival curves. I'm going to talk to you a little bit in a minute about how to read some of these curves effectively, but this is one where we look at patients who have a PSA doubling time over here on this side. These are patients who have a, this is prostate cancer specific survival. So the likelihood of dying of prostate cancer with a rapidly rising PSA versus a less rapidly rising PSA. So the curve that goes down here is patients whose PSA doubling time is 3 months or less. Very rapid doubling time. And those patients, about half of them, have died of the disease after about 6 years of being diagnosed. And that's a very rapid clinical course, whereas the patient who has a doubling time that's significantly longer than that is the curve across the top. And those patients are, in this curve, very unlikely to die of prostate cancer. The curves over here on the other side look at a split point of 12 months or less. And as you can see, once again, prostate cancer-specific survival, patients with that with a very, very slowly rising PSA are unlikely to die of prostate cancer, at least in the 5 years following. And so those patients we might manage a little bit more conservatively. So our approach with the patient with a rising PSA is I ask two questions. Question one, and this is a very important question, is this patient still curable? And can I eliminate this disease one way or another and allow this patient to live the rest of his life without any treatment? And so that depends on what's happened with them previously. So some patients may have radical prostatectomy, that's RP, or they may have radiation therapy, RT. And so there might be patients who've had a radical prostatectomy, and they come in to see me, and they have a slowly rising PSA, and maybe they had a positive surgical margin, meaning when the surgeon took out the prostate, there was a little bit of cancer there right where they cut. And the surgeons can't see this. It's not, you just don't know this occurs until later on. Well, many of those patients can actually be cured by giving them radiation therapy to the prostate bed, because simply what's happened is a little bit of cancer has spilled outside of the prostate gland, and that is essentially a target for the radiation therapy. So that's a good situation to have. So some of these patients are curable. The next question is this disease systemic or localized? Now, as I just showed you, those patients who have a PSA doubling time of 3 months or less, that's a very rapidly rising PSA, and it's really most realistic to think of that as a systemic condition. This is cancer that's circulating in the blood, perhaps in the lymph channels, perhaps it's in the bone marrow. And while there may not be tumors in the bone or that would show up on the scan, it's still a process that's in the circulation. Okay, so that's probably somebody in whom the radiation therapy may not work, and it's probably somebody in whom I'm going to consider hormonal therapy. And then finally, I've touched on this, is if I'm going to deliver radiation therapy after radical prostatectomy, should we do concurrent androgen deprivation therapy? All questions that we would face with a patient in the clinic who has had a local therapy of some kind. Mostly we do radiation after surgery. We do relatively little surgery after radiation. Hormonal therapy, as time goes on, is changing. There are new treatment options looking at doing hormonal therapy. Now I'm talking about lowering the testosterone level, doing this on an intermittent basis. We might do a year on or a year off. It's a little controversial, and there are only certain circumstances in which we do this. We're exploring the use of what we call peripheral androgen blockade. And by that, I mean we're trying to block the receptors without blocking the production of the testosterone. And so we have some new drugs, some new therapies that are very promising in that regard that we're testing. High-dose bicalutamide is something that's been done for years. We're testing currently a drug called ARN-509, which is a new generation androgen receptor antagonist that may be something that could replace the standard androgen-reducing types of therapies. And the reason we want to try to limit the amount of time a patient spends on hormonal therapy is that there are a lot of side effects. And, you know, a lot of people think about hormonal therapy and androgen deprivation, and two things come to mind, hot flashes and erectile dysfunction. But actually, there's a lot more to it than that. When we induce an androgen deprivation, when we use androgen deprivation therapy in a man, really what we're doing is pretty much the same physiological process that occurs in a woman when she undergoes menopause. Now, this may occur much later in the man's life than it would in the woman's, but a lot of the processes are very, very similar, and I've listed them here, and I'm going to talk about them in more detail. It's really this idea that we're going to induce a slowing of the metabolism, a change in the body shape, a change in the body morphology, and that will bring along with it many, many side effects, and I'm going to talk some about that. So here's a study that was published a few years ago. It's a very interesting graph. It's looking at fat mass and insulin along two different axes on the graph. And so these are patients over a three-month period treated with an LHRH analog. And so fat mass change in kilograms is along here. So as you can see, most men had some increase in their fat mass, and then most men had, and the trend for the group overall was an increase in both of these. Now, an increase in insulin means that the patient's body is having trouble adjusting to the slowed metabolism, so it's trying to use more insulin to bring down the blood sugar. And really what I mean by that process is a term called insulin resistance, which really becomes a precursor to diabetes. And this is a big problem in patients who are on hormonal therapy, is there's roughly a 50% increase incidence in this one study that was published in the incidence of type 2 diabetes. And that is a metabolic toxicity of androgen deprivation therapy. We don't know if it's specific to the androgen deprivation therapy or not, or whether it's just a consequence of the weight gain, but there's about a 10 to 20% increased risk of cardiovascular disease in these patients as well. Okay, so this is a big deal because we're going to control the cancer, but we don't want to cause another life-threatening problem in doing so, and so we need to be very, very attentive to these issues. So the good news is that, remember, if you looked at that graph from the last slide, not every patient gained weight and not every patient's insulin went up. And why is that? Well, exercise. Exercise is a very important part of being on hormonal therapy. We push exercise on our patients. In fact, we have a special program. We have a couple of special studies going on looking at the effects of exercise in men who have been diagnosed with prostate cancer who are on ADT. I'll bring to your attention this one trial that was published a few years ago now, over 10 years ago, which I quote to my patients quite frequently, which is patients were randomly selected while they were on hormone therapy to be given a pamphlet saying you should go exercise, and here's what you should do, or the intervention, which was they would come into a gym and they would train with a trainer 3 days per week, and it was resistance exercise. It was dumbbells and barbells and squats and all of that kind of stuff. And over the course of 12 weeks, there were statistically significant findings, not only in reducing the fatigue that can come with hormonal therapy, but overall, quality of life improved with those men who had the supervised resistance exercise program. So I very frequently tell patients that they should maybe meet with a trainer. Sometimes we have them go to physical therapists, and I try to get them off the couch if they've been sedentary, because it's a very important quality of life measure. And I suspect that if we follow these patients long enough, that we would see that some of these patients who exercise may have fewer complications from their disease and may even live longer. And so we're just about to start a study in the next months or so where we're actually going to take patients with very advanced prostate cancer, even those with metastasis and the androgen-resistant type, the castration resistance, and we're going to be testing exercise interventions in those patients with a goal of seeing if it actually slows down the disease and helps them to live longer. A couple of other things is with the exercise, we're really focusing on fatigue and quality of life. But really, the other thing we're doing is we're doing resistance and gravity and weight bearing, and that has implications for bone health. And it's widely known that postmenopausal women are prone to osteoporosis and osteoporotic fractures. But men are just as men, especially who are on androgen deprivation therapy, are at almost equal or greater risk from this complication than postmenopausal women. So think of the confluence then of osteoporosis that can occur during androgen deprivation therapy plus the presence of bone metastasis. We're going to have a high risk for bone complications. Bone complications in a prostate cancer patient typically can be fractures, pain, and the most feared one is compression of the spinal cord by tumor. And fortunately, that's a very rare event. As an oncologist who specializes in prostate cancer, I see maybe only 2 cases of this per year. So it's become less common with better therapies, but it's often a very devastating complication. But fractures are very, very common. And this is a picture that was drawn by Frank Netter, the famous medical illustrator who, he died about 25 years ago. But he was even drawing about the compression of the spinal cord in men over time as they age. And this was nothing to do with androgen deprivation therapy, but he has a 55-year-old on the left, then a 65, and then a 75-year-old. And he illustrates what's prone to happen, which is a gradual compression of the vertebral bodies. And that's why men as they age can frequently get shorter. Now, we are going to compound that problem by taking the testosterone away and thinning those bones even further. Well, the good news is that, and this slide doesn't show up that great, but the good news is we can reverse that process a little bit. And we can do that with different therapies. There's one called zoledronic acid, which is on the market, and we use it very frequently. And the other is called denosumab. And these are both very potent agents that essentially put calcium into the bone and fortify the bone. And what's not showing up here is that the light blue is a control group of patients from years ago. That is the change in lumbar spine density. And there, upward is getting less dense. It's bone loss. And then the patients who are on therapy, their bone loss actually decreases and their bones actually get stronger. So you're going to have to trust me on the quality of the slide, but we can improve the bone mineral density with therapies, but also weight-bearing exercise, taking calcium and vitamin D are important. And this is something where we're hoping to shift the curve from what we saw decades ago. And this is a slide that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine many decades ago, about two decades ago, looking at androgen deprivation therapy and its risk for fractures. As you can see, patients who had an orchiectomy had their testicles removed. By the time you get out to 8 or 9 years post that event, 50% of the patients have had some kind of a fracture. And I think that that's not occurring with quite the same frequency because of all of the stress we're putting on exercise and other things. So, when we think about these issues, there's a couple more pieces of information on this. A hip fracture in a man, and similar to a hip fracture in a postmenopausal woman, can be a deadly event. In fact, in some studies, there have been 20% mortalities reported within 6 months of such a fracture in elderly men, and that's a higher mortality rate than it is in women. And here's a better slide looking at the use of zoledronic acid once per year, which is quite remarkable, change in baseline for bone markers, basically bone turnover markers showing that the bone is likely to be breaking down. And so these are blood tests showing that the bones are breaking down. And on a placebo, one placebo treatment, those markers continued to rise over time. And with the one treatment of the zoledronic acid, that went down quite significantly. So these are the two therapies that we have, zoledronic acid and denosumab, and they've really become a standard part of our clinical use. So I'm proud to announce that we have a new program at UCSF that is specifically directed at patients who are on hormonal therapy and trying to confront and delay and improve all of these complications. We call it the STAND Clinic, and pictured here is my colleague Rahul Agarwal. He is the medical director of the STAND Clinic. And this is open to any man who is on hormonal therapy, is expected to be on hormonal therapy for a year or greater with prostate cancer. And the whole goal is to put them through a series of modules that look at nutrition, exercise, emotional well-being, relationships, and exercise, if I didn't mention that one already. And so patients come in once a month, and really it's an educational experience, but you get your you get your exercise training from an exercise physiologist, you get your nutrition training from a nutritionist. We have Dr. Rabo and his colleagues from our symptom management service deal with some of the emotional as well as the symptom control side issues related to this, and it's become a very popular program in our clinic, and we're now moving into a phase where we're testing it against standard of care, hopefully demonstrating that the outcomes of patients who get this active intervention, similar to that exercise study I showed you before, that the outcomes of those patients will be favorable and that it will be worth all of this effort of coming in once a month. Oddly or sadly, the standard of care for a patient on hormonal therapy in many urology practices is to not be seen but once every 3 months, and there's really not a lot of focus given to these issues of nutrition and exercise, and that's something we hope to change. So I'm now going to transition, and I'm going to talk about different therapies that we use that are directly targeting the cancer. And so remember that we have this problem in advanced prostate cancer. The hormone therapy may work. The hormone therapy may work alone for 10 years, for 5 years, for quite some time. But eventually we get to a situation in many patients, not all, but many patients, where we've suppressed the testosterone and the cancer progresses anyway. Castration-resistant prostate cancer, CRPC. So the good news is that we have a number of new therapies that are available. I'm going to walk you through a few of these, those that have become recently approved and that we use quite a bit in the clinic. I'm going to start with this class of agents called the CYP17 inhibitors. And I'm going to go back to Dr. Huggins and Hodges. It seems like every lecture on prostate cancer has to refer to them at least once or twice. And Charles Huggins won the Nobel Prize for this discovery of hormonal therapy. The paper was published in 1941, but he got his Nobel Prize in 1966. And so as he's giving his lecture in Stockholm, he says, "Despite regressions of great magnitude, it is obvious that there are many failures of endocrine therapy or hormone therapy to control the disease." And he was talking about castration-resistant prostate cancer. My colleague, Eric Small, who's now our chief of oncology here, wrote a paper back in 1997, published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, where he and Nicholas Vogelsang said they coined the term secondary hormonal therapy. And what that meant was that there were still possibilities that we could use hormone treatments even in the setting of hormone treatment failure. And that was a bit of a change in our thinking and has led to some very important new treatments. So first let's think about, again, about the hormone cascade and about what happens. So there's androgen production. We talked about that, usually coming from the testicles. But even if you remove the testicles in a man, there will still be testosterone. Most of that testosterone is coming from the adrenal glands, and some of it may be coming from some other organs, and some of it may be coming from the tumor itself. So this has become a therapeutic target. Target the production of those residual androgens, and that's what I'm going to talk about first, and then I'm going to talk about targeting the androgen receptor itself. But first, one of the most important observations of the last decade, I think, is this data, that as this cancer progresses, it can actually make its own testosterone. And that's quite a fascinating thing. And that tells you a little bit about cancer in general. Cancer in general, what makes it the bad disease is it as a disease has a will to survive. And what it does is it adapts to the treatments that we throw at it. So if there's a prostate cancer out there thriving on lots of testosterone, and we take 90% of that testosterone away, we're going to kill a lot of cancer. And that's how hormone therapy works. But some of that cancer that remains is going to evolve, it's going to mutate, whatever term you want to use, it's going to change its nature to the point where it can survive in a low testosterone milieu. And there are a number of examples of this in nature, of course. I always think about you can go to the desert in the driest time of the year and there will still be plants growing there. And how do they do that? We don't know. But prostate cancer can make its own testosterone. And this is data looking at gene expression from different enzymes that are responsible for androgen production taken from the tumor itself, which these little dots, each of these dots is a patient sample in a metastasis. CP is a prostate cancer in the prostate, and BP is benign prostate. And it's a little bit hard to see, but this is the enzyme AKR1C3 that controls production of testosterone series of chemical reactions. And as you can see, when we compare the BP to the CP and then look at the METs, the average value of this enzyme has gone up quite a bit. And when we look at 17-beta-hydroxysteroid dehydrogenase, yeah, you have to go to school for a long time to be able to say that really quick. But when you look at that one, it goes up even faster. And then when you look at all of these other enzymes that are associated with this, you see most of them are going up. So the cancer has increased its production of these enzymes that are responsible for androgen production. So we have drugs that can look at that, that can target that. And the one I'm going to talk about now is a treatment called abiraterone. And abiraterone is an orally available, it's a pill. It is essentially a hormone. It is a derivative of progesterone, and it was discovered in a lab in London where they were working on studying progesterone and other female hormones, and they found that with this chemical derivative, they were able to block androgen production in this chemical pathway. And so this is something we learn in medical school, which is the adrenal steroid synthesis pathway, which leads to three different classes of steroids that our body needs to survive. Aldosterone, which we call the salt steroids, controls blood pressure and water and salt balance. Cortisol, which is called the glucocorticoid or the sugar corticoid. And on the bottom are the testosterones, or what we call the sex steroids. So you remember this in medical school by learning salt, sugar, and sex. And abiraterone blocks very effectively the androgen part. And that can lead to significant regressions of the disease that we'll talk about in a minute. But it can also lead to imbalances in some of the other hormones. And so this particular therapy has to be given with prednisone, which decreases the risk from the elevation of the salt steroids. So I'm going to talk about the clinical results with this drug and when we use it. Before I do that, I thought it'd be nice to actually look at what we do when we're talking about clinical trials in oncology and how we read results. And you've probably seen curves like this before. And I just thought it might be kind of nice to go through this for 30 seconds and talk about how to read these. So this is called a Kaplan-Meier plot. And it was developed by two statisticians, Kaplan and Meyer. And the idea of a Kaplan-Meier plot is to not exactly tell you how long people live or at what rate or anything like that. It's really to look at the hazard ratio, which is abbreviated here as HR, which is really the risk of an event happening. Okay, so this is a you'll see this curve later, but this is a treatment for prostate cancer that was compared to placebo. And the yellow is the treatment. And at any given point along the bottom, you have time, and then you have the proportion surviving along the top. So when you start the study, everybody's alive. And then over time, events start to happen. And what you see is a different rate of events, a different hazard ratio occurring between the two arms. And in this particular study, the benefits of the therapy come in the form of the difference between the blue and the yellow line, this space right there. And what that means is that's associated with a hazard ratio of 0.695, 0.7. That's a 30% reduction in death for patients who got the treatment versus those who did not get the treatment. Okay? Now, in reality, the median survival on this curve is where 50% of the patients have died in both arms. So here it's 11.2 months, and here it's 14 months. And so many people look at these and they say, well, the survival is only 3 months because it's 14 versus 11. But that's not exactly true. The hazard ratio is 0.7, which means that at any given point along treatment, if you got the treatment, you were 30% more likely to be alive than if you had gotten the placebo. And that's really where the statistics comes out in this. And so when I look at these, I look at a couple things. I look at when the curves separate. Do they separate right away or do they separate late? I look at the width of the banana, as one of my colleagues calls it, and there's a test that we use sometimes, the two-finger test. If you're reading this on a paper and you can put two fingers between the curve, that's a very significant result. And then you want to look at what happens at the end of the study, how many patients are around, how many patients have gone that long, lived that long, been on the treatment that long, and what are the long-term outcomes. So if you had a treatment, for example, that cured 20% of people and everybody else died, you would see a curve that would come down and like this would flatten out forever because 20% never experienced that event. 20% never experienced that event. So I think that's useful because I'm going to show you now a number of these plots as we think about the integration of new therapies and how they're progressively and incrementally adding to the survival of men with this disease. So this drug we just got done talking about, abiraterone, in patients who had already received chemotherapy, very, very sick group of patients who had no other treatment options available, it improved the survival by 35%. hazard ratio of 0.65, highly statistically significant value, but as you can see, a relatively small increment in the median survival. But this was a very positive result with this particular drug and led to its approval by the FDA. We'll see in a minute that this drug is actually used more frequently in the pre-chemotherapy space where the benefits may actually be greater. There are a number of options, a number of potential outcomes for patients who are treated with abiraterone or drugs like it. They can respond, and we have patients who respond for 3 or 4 years. They can have primary resistance, meaning they don't respond at all, and can have very significantly progressive disease. They can have a resistance that we call a phenotypic change, wholesale change in the type of cancer that they have emerging under treatment with this. And the reality is that a large proportion of patients who receive abiraterone or receive chemotherapy for prostate cancer have a long survival during the course of which many events happen. We call these the landmarks of disease progression. So imagine a patient comes in to see me, his PSA is 10, he's got 1 or 2 bone metastases, he's been on androgen deprivation therapy for 3 or 4 years. That patient has a fairly good prognosis, but he has a lot of concern. What can we do to keep the PSA down? What can we do to prevent the PSA from progressing? What can we do to prevent that patient who has 3 or 4 bone metastases from getting 8 or 12 or 15 or 30 bone metastases? What can I do to prevent him from having pain? What can I do to prevent him from needing chemotherapy? What can I do to prevent him from having a decline in his performance status? Performance status means his ability to function. So we designed a trial. I worked on this project with this drug abiraterone that designed to test these primary endpoints. How long will it take until the tumor progresses in the bone? How long will it take until the patient, how long will the patient survive after receiving these treatments? But now as we're doing clinical trials, we're actually asking a lot more questions than just that. We're asking, you know, what's happening with the PSA? We're asking, does it delay chemotherapy? We're asking, does it delay the time until the patient gets pain? Because a lot of these patients don't have pain, and we're trying to prevent it. For patients who have pain, we're trying to alleviate it, and that's another very important thing that we try to do. How long will it be until that patient's performance status declines, and how can we look at that in a rigorous clinical trial? So here's a design of a randomized phase 3 trial that was with abiraterone, and we were able to lead this out of UCSF. It was an international study of 151 sites at 12 countries, and it was sponsored by Johnson & Johnson, who makes this drug or provides this drug now. But the idea behind that study was to take patients who had castration-resistant prostate cancer who did not have symptoms, were not in pain, and see how long we could delay those events from happening. And the patients we treated were sort of like that patient I described. Median PSA was 42. They all had very, very low testosterone levels. They were required to have that. But they all had bone metastases. And so as you can see in the shaded area in the bottom, about 50% of the patients who entered this trial had 10 bone metastases. So if you haven't had a lot of exposure to prostate cancer, it might come as a surprise that 50% of patients with 10 bone metastases or greater do not have any pain or symptoms from their disease. And that is the reality. Remember that bone scan that I showed you at the very beginning, we had all of those lesions throughout that body of that patient, and that patient didn't have pain. And that is a true event that occurs quite frequently. So with that, patients were treated with this drug, abiraterone plus prednisone, or they received a placebo plus prednisone. And you might be asking, why would we use a placebo? And the reality is that for patients who have not had chemotherapy, who do not have pain, there, up until very recently, was not a standard of care. So the Food and Drug Administration in the United States would say, you can use a placebo if there's no standard of care because we can't tell you what you should compare your drug to. And that's exactly what happened. And in this particular trial, this is what we saw. This is the radiographic progression-free survival primary endpoint of this study, where we showed that taking abiraterone actually led to a doubling of the time until the disease progressed in the bone. And that was from 8 months to a little over seven, almost 17 months. This is not yet reached at the initial value, but later it was reached. The hazard ratio there was 0.43. So that meant that taking this drug reduced by 57% the likelihood at any given time that the disease had progressed. Looking at survival, we see a very different shaped curve. This curve has been updated and has subsequently matured a little bit and will continue to mature as the study ages. But we saw that with respect to median survival, those who received the placebo survived about 27 months. And as it turns out, those who had received the abiraterone, the survival was about 33 months in there. So statistically significant improvement in radiographic progression and an improvement in overall survival. And that led to this drug being approved by the FDA for pre-chemotherapy use or for chemotherapy-naive patients. But let's get back to that point that I was making before about pain and delaying pain and all those other things. So here's where we see these secondary endpoints as well as patient-reported outcomes that we'll talk about. Time to opiate use in the placebo arm took 2 years. So this is a patient with a PSA of 46. 50% of them had 10 bone metastases, and they took 10 milligrams of prednisone, and it took an average of 2 years until they experienced pain, and that value had not yet been reached in the abiraterone arm. Time to chemotherapy, 17 months versus 25 months, again, a significant delay, and significant delays in the time until the performance status deteriorates and until the PSA progresses. Here is the opiate use curve, and again, getting to that hazard ratio, it delayed by about 31% the likelihood of a patient having pain and requiring a morphine-like drug. So that's a positive finding, and the FDA reviewed that favorably. These are the patient-reported outcomes from this study. So these are not what the doctor thinks is going on. These are what the patients are telling us is going on. And there are a number of quality of life scores that we use in clinical trials where basically when a patient comes to see you or even they take it home with them, they fill out questionnaires. And these questionnaires have been adapted over the years to become very reliable. So the fact G is the general quality of life. Prostate cancer specific is PCS is a prostate cancer specific quality of life. Physical, functional, emotional, and social family well-being are relatively self-explanatory. And the p-values here are very, very low, which if you know statistics would suggest that for all of these arms, there was a significant benefit in terms of treating patients with the abiraterone in terms of quality of life as the patients reported it. This is a curve looking at overall function status degradation. And I look at this curve and I think, well, it's good. I mean, there's a statistically significant finding, but we still got a long way to go. And it still gives us impetus to continue to try to develop new therapies because the reality is with this therapy that most patients did experience a degradation in their functional status and they did experience progression of their disease. Another very similar drug, which we are beginning to know a lot more about because the clinical trials are a little bit behind the abiraterone trials but are maturing rapidly, is enzalutamide. Enzalutamide, like abiraterone, is orally available. It's a pill. This was actually invented at UCLA by somebody who trained here at UCSF. And what they did is they took existing hormonal therapies, existing androgen receptor blocking drugs, and they tweaked them chemically. That's a common way to discover new drugs. And they found a very, very potent drug that they called MDV-3100, subsequently called enzalutamide. Now, enzalutamide has been through essentially the same process as abiraterone, so I'm not going to repeat the design of the trials. And I'm going to show you that the most recent trial, which is called the PREVAIL trial, compares very favorably to the abiraterone trial insofar as the patients were roughly the same. Median PSA, about 50. Remember, in the abiraterone trials, 46. And the vast majority of them had bone disease. A small proportion of them had visceral disease, liver metastasis, and that type of thing. But when we compare these curves side by side, we see two very active agents. We see two very good drugs that are generally well tolerated, significant effects on slowing the progression of the disease, and significant effects on delaying death from this disease. The progression-free survival curves on top, and then the overall survival curves are on the bottom. And enzalutamide is important because just as I told you that the prostate cancer can begin to make its own testosterone, the other thing that happens is the receptor level goes up as the disease progresses. And this is a series of studies published over many years that have looked at advanced prostate cancer compared to non-advanced prostate cancer, and have consistently shown that the receptor is expressed, the receptor is made and retained and amplified in these specimens, and this has been proven even by doing autopsies on men who have died of this disease. So we have two very active agents, and now what we're doing is we're trying to see if A plus B is better than A or B. And so we have a very big, large-scale effort, clinical trial underway in the U.S. and Canada, which is combining enzalutamide and abiraterone. It turns out patients need to take 10 pills a day if they're on arm B of this trial. But we think it's hopefully going to be worth it because they're relatively well-tolerated, and hopefully we're going to improve that survival curve even more. So these results are encouraging. I showed you that we're slowing down the disease. People are living longer. We're not talking about chemotherapy here. We're not talking about really toxic treatments. But the question comes up, if these treatments are so good, what if we go to earlier stage disease? Maybe we can cure some people. So again, getting back to that question that I first ask as a patient comes into my clinic, is this patient still curable? Well, here's a study that goes to the earliest you can intervene. Men who are diagnosed with prostate cancer, who are curable with surgery, but at high risk for relapse. And this is a study done at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, led by my colleague Mary Ellen Taplin. And what they did is they took high-risk patients who were going to have surgery, and all of them received 24 weeks of standard hormonal therapy. One half of the group received 12 weeks of abiraterone, this very potent second treatment, and half of them received 24 weeks of the abiraterone, and then they all underwent surgery, and their prostates were removed to see what was there. So what was found was quite interesting, which was in the patients who took 24 weeks of the abiraterone, that's the right-hand column, 34% of them, they could not find any cancer when they removed the prostate. It was 15% for those in whom they had taken the abiraterone for 12 weeks. And these were high-risk patients. These were not patients with very, very small tumors. Many of them had very, very large tumors. So this is quite remarkable. If we're able to cure 30% of patients with essentially six months of treatment who would otherwise relapse and maybe die from this disease, that's quite remarkable. Now, these are not data that have changed the standard of care yet, because as you've noticed, the numbers, the sample size, the number of patients treated with this program is very, very small. So this needs to be validated. We need to do this in a larger group of patients to really determine if this is something that's going to happen. And the one thing we don't know is we haven't yet proven that taking out the prostate and not finding any cancer means there's no cancer there. We just don't see it. So it might be that it's even more microscopic, and we need to approach finding it from a different perspective. So now I'm going to change gears again, and I'm going to talk about something else that we do, which is not hormonal therapy and not chemotherapy. It's immune therapy. And this is an area that's a really very exciting area, a process that's happening in a lot of different cancers. But it was prostate cancer where immune therapy in its sort of modern form really became a standard approach. So this is a schematic picture of how an immune therapy may differ from a different type of therapy like a chemotherapy. Imagine a tumor that's growing and you give a treatment. Well, the expectation is that you would reduce the size of the tumor and you would reduce the burden of the cancer, and that if you stop that treatment, that the cancer might bounce back. And that's the red line here. Chemotherapy reduces burden while you're on the treatment and then it bounces back. And immunotherapy is probably unlikely to do that, although that may be challenged. But the immune therapy in inducing an immunity against the cancer may slow the progression of the disease. Now, I didn't make up this graphic, and I think it's a little bit optimistic that after the time on treatment tumor burden reduces. But I think it's more realistic that if you follow the arrow, that after the vaccine is given, the curve may flatten out. And so I think of it as, you might have a vehicle that's moving forward, And it's one thing to push the vehicle into reverse, but it's another thing to slow the vehicle down. Maybe what immune therapy will do in prostate cancer is slow the vehicle down. So we currently have one treatment that is available that's on the market. It's got a trade name called Provenge. It's also called Sapulisil-T, and has a very interesting story. And much of it started here at our institution, where the first people were dosed with it well over a decade ago, about 15 years ago. The idea behind this treatment is that a patient undergoes a procedure called leukapheresis, where a proportion of their white blood cells are removed, and they are shipped to a facility where they are stimulated against antigens that are part of prostate cancer. And so it's a little bit like getting a flu shot or getting a polio vaccine or something, where you expose the patient's immune system to a little part of the disease to try to get it to recognize it. But this is done outside of the body. The cells are removed, they're exposed, and then the cells are brought back and reinfused into the patient. And the curves along the bottom were some of the early studies that were done that demonstrated a very modest slowing of the disease. Not that impressive, not statistically significant, and it looked like this wasn't going to pan out to be much. But over time, patients were followed, and it turned out that patients who got the vaccine, compared to those who had gotten a placebo at the time, were living longer. And so a pivotal study was done called the IMPACT trial. And this study was notable for a couple of things, a couple of reasons. One, it was the first study to go into that asymptomatic, kind of low disease burden group of patients like we talked about before. PSAs 25, 30, 40, that range, no pain, didn't need chemotherapy, had a fairly good prognosis. And those patients were exposed to Provenge, which they get only three times. It's not an ongoing treatment, or a placebo. And when those patients who got the placebo, when their cancer progressed, they were allowed to cross over and get the Provenge. And that's another important part about reading phase three trials, is you want to know if the patients in the control arm actually got the treatment, because in many cases they do. And this is a situation where they did. So what this trial demonstrated was about a 22.5% improvement in survival for patients who got the Provenge, and that was a hazard ratio of 0.775. So a modest improvement in survival, but it was very well tolerated, only some flu-like symptoms in some patients, and this drug then has been approved by the FDA. And we do use it. We use it in those patients who have a relatively low burden of disease, who are asymptomatic. One of the curves that's kind of interesting is to look at the 1, 2, 3, and 4 year survival of patients who got the Provenge or the placebo on this trial. And what's quite interesting is the survival benefit for those who survived 3 years was almost 40%. So patients who are in that category, who live that long, their survival is lengthened by quite a significant amount. So again, I give this to good prognosis patients for the most part. It's not a remission-inducing treatment, and that's one of the key points, is it doesn't reduce the tumor burden, it doesn't bring down the PSA, it doesn't shrink tumors, and it doesn't alleviate pain, but it may slow down those events from happening. So now we're exploring, where do we go next? How do we detect immunity? Can we boost this? Can we combine it with other treatments? And a lot of that kind of work is ongoing in our clinical trial center as well as in others. I'm going to go back and talk a little bit more about... Actually, I'm going to skip over this slide in the interest of time and move on to my last two sections. So I'm going to talk about chemotherapy because I've alluded to it a lot. And most people, when they think about oncology and they think about cancer treatment, they think we give a lot of chemotherapy. The reality is, in my practice, I give very little chemotherapy. On a given day, when I see somewhere between 15 and 20 patients, I may have one or two patients who are receiving it. But the truth is, chemotherapy works against this disease. However, we need to improve its outcome. So this is a Kaplan-Meier curve from a long time ago. It's now well over a decade. And this was the first... This is the trial that was the first trial to demonstrate that a systemic treatment, in this case chemotherapy, could improve survival for men with prostate cancer. When I was doing my training, many people would look at prostate cancer and they would say, well, nothing's ever been shown to improve survival. Nothing works. Well, it took some long studies, but it was eventually shown that this drug, docetaxel, when given every 3 weeks, led to about a 20% improvement, 25% improvement in survival, compared to an old chemotherapy called mitoxantrone. Mitoxantrone had been approved by the FDA in the early 1990s for its palliative effects. It reduced pain and reduced the need for opiate analgesics, but it didn't have a significant impact on the population in slowing down the disease. So docetaxel did that, and that was a very important moment in the history of this disease, and it became a drug that we could use reliably that would help patients live longer. It did alleviate pain, it did reduce PSA, and it did shrink tumors, and it still does, but eventually those treatments wear off and the disease progresses. So now there are new derivatives, and there's one called cabazitaxel, and unfortunately this, if you're into three-dimensional chemical structures, this is a little bit upside down, but docetaxel and cabazitaxel are two very related drugs. And it's an interesting story because what scientists did was they took docetaxel, this drug that we had shown has some benefit, and they exposed cancer cells in the test tube to it. And if you expose cancer cells in the test tube long enough to a drug, well, you're going to kill off the sensitive cells, but eventually resistant cells are going to grow out. So that's what they did. They got the resistant cells that grew out in the dish, and they grew those cells. And then what they did is they took their original docetaxel drug and made all kinds of different chemical changes on it. And that's highlighted here. And basically what the yellow shows you is just two little changes to the chemistry of docetaxel. So when they did it with this particular agent, cabazitaxel, they found that it killed the cells that were resistant to the docetaxel. Okay, so that was a signal that they should put it into humans who had already received docetaxel. And that's in fact what was done. There was a clinical trial done in many countries around the world that looked at cabazitaxel, comparing it to mitoxantrone, only in patients in whom docetaxel had stopped working. And lo and behold, there was a 28% improvement in survival with this particular agent. So this was FDA approved and is out there and is in use in the population. One of the very interesting things about this story is that when the FDA approved this drug, they mandated that this drug be compared to docetaxel as a frontline treatment, not only in the resistant patients. And that study's underway now. We don't know the results, but it was quite a story for the FDA to mandate that of a pharmaceutical company, because docetaxel is now generic, very inexpensive. Cabazitaxel is not generic, and it's very expensive. And so if those results show that the generic old drug is just as good as the expensive new drug, it'll be bad for the pharmaceutical industry, but it'll be good for Medicare and good for patients in terms of saving money. It'll be bad for patients because it won't be an advance necessarily, and we want to see advances. So how do we use chemotherapy? Again, we're really using it a lot today in the palliative mode, patients who have advanced disease, maybe with pain, et cetera, and are with rapid progression and with symptoms. But recently, in the last month, in fact, we've had a really exciting new finding with chemotherapy that's worth mentioning. This is the design of what's called the CHARTED study, which was chemotherapy and AR-targeted treatment. This was a study that was started long ago, and it was for patients who are newly diagnosed with prostate cancer who are going on androgen deprivation therapy. They were randomly selected to receive standard androgen deprivation therapy, that's arm B, or to get standard androgen deprivation therapy with 6 cycles of docetaxel chemotherapy. So this is what we call hormone-sensitive disease. It's not the castration-resistant disease where we're using abiraterone and enzalutamide and Provenge. And what was discovered is, I think, quite remarkable. For patients who had greater than 4 bone metastases, receiving chemotherapy improved survival by 40%. For that 40% was a 17-month improvement in median survival. And in the land of phase 3 trials, that's a very significant survival benefit and is likely to change the standard of care for that group of patients. Interestingly, for patients who had less than 4 bone metastases, there wasn't as much of a survival improvement seen, but most of the patients with the low volume of disease entered into that clinical trial in the latter part of that trial's life, and so most of those patients are still alive, And the survival curve is likely to change over time. And so I wouldn't state yet that we will not see a benefit with the low-volume disease. And this is quite a remarkable thing, and it really changes the dynamics of how we're going to treat newly diagnosed prostate cancer. And so we're seeing referrals to our clinic now for patients to get early chemotherapy. And the reality is giving chemotherapy at the beginning of hormone therapy is easier than giving it after hormone therapy fails for two reasons. One is the patient's body has not undergone all of those metabolic changes associated with the hormonal therapy. And then the other is that they're 6 years younger than they would be if we waited for them to develop castration resistance. And so it's just a slightly different patient population, and that's quite a significant finding that we will be following and watching it mature. Final drug I'm going to talk about is actually not a drug. It's radium-223. I'm going to show you here for the first time the periodic table of the elements. I like that, you know, prostate cancer is really becoming a very multidisciplinary, good general knowledge kind of disease to know about, because we showed the adrenal steroid synthesis pathway, and that's something everybody learns in first months of medical school, and the periodic table of elements is something everybody learns in their first month of general chemistry. And so it's kind of fun to be thinking about these things. But in the periodic table of elements, we have calcium and radium are highlighted, and they're in the same row in the periodic table, which, for those of you who don't know much chemistry, that means they act in a similar way. They're just different size molecules. And it was Madame Curie who, in the turn of the last century, was working at the Norway Radium Hospital, or the Norway, it was a radiation center where they were studying all this, and she and her husband won several Nobel Prizes for this work. They discovered that taking radium and applying it to tumors caused the tumors to regress. And the reason it did that, and she actually published a paper in 1906 in Science, in which she stated that the use of radium-223, the use of radioisotope radium, could be an exciting treatment for cancer. And it wasn't until 2011, 105 years later, that we actually proved her right. And what happens with radium is that the radium is like calcium. It's injected into the veins, and it goes everywhere that calcium would go, mostly into the bone. So you've got this hungry bone that's healing from this cancer that's growing there. It's trying to heal. And instead of taking up calcium, it takes up radium. And radium has a alpha particle, which is a radioactive particle that is emitted from the molecule, from the atom. And it travels a short distance, as shown here by the yellow circle. That's the range of the alpha particle. So we've delivered, in a way, kind of like this Trojan horse, into the bone. And then we've shot this really high energy beam of radiation just this very, very, very short distance, just enough to kill the cancer cell sitting nearby, but probably not long enough to kill the nearby normal bone marrow cells that are growing. And so this becomes a radioisotope with anti-tumor properties. And this was subjected to a placebo-controlled randomized phase 3 trial. And this was for patients who have advanced disease with pain, and or were unfit for chemotherapy. So these were patients who were quite sick. And this is the curve. This is the curve I showed you earlier. And this treatment, giving this radium, improved survival by 31%, statistically significant, and a few months improvement in the median survival. So this is something that has entered into the clinic now with a bit of excitement, because it's a relatively easy thing to do. It's a simple injection once a month into the veins, and the side effects are pretty minimal. There are some effects on the bone marrow. For some reason, it does cause some diarrhea in patients, and it can cause some fatigue. So it is, on the other hand, yet another agent that improves survival. So that's the last of the new treatments that I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of my predictions on this disease. Prediction number one is that we will continue to develop orally well-tolerated therapies, and that's a good thing. We're gradually getting away from the infusion chemotherapy types of things, or we're finding the more appropriate niche for those. prostate cancer in the advanced setting, as well as prostate cancer in the localized setting, the non-advanced patients, is becoming a model of cost-effectiveness research. These drugs are very expensive. These clinical trials that I showed you, you may be surprised to hear, cost hundreds of millions of dollars to do. So these aren't the kinds of things we do on an NIH grant or do on a shoestring here at UCSF or any other institution for that matter. They are major global efforts that require a huge amount of investment. We haven't talked about this much, but the management of castration-resistant prostate cancer will be done by those who understand the biology of the disease, which is getting very complex. Combined oral therapies will push therapy and survival further. And one of the things that's happening is because we have new drugs that can help people live longer, you know, by giving them a first-line treatment that's effective, when that treatment fails, they're more likely to get second-line treatment. And so it's a little bit of a, you know, it's kind of a snowball effect. More patients are getting first-line therapy, therefore more patients are getting second-line therapy. And finally, new treatments are going to need to be developed in conjunction with biomarkers that predict response. I showed you all these Kaplan-Meier curves, and I said there's a 30% improvement in survival here and a 22.5% improvement in survival there. But the reality is I would love to get up here and say, we identified a group of patients because of this blood test we did or this marker we saw on their tumor, and we see a 100% improvement in survival. And we do see that in some cancers. We've seen that in some leukemias. We're seeing that even in some forms of lung cancer now. And we have not yet seen that in prostate cancer, where we have developed a diagnostic test that predicts whether a patient will benefit or not from a particular therapy. So we still have a lot of work to do in that regard. And so this is a little bit of a landscape view of where we are with prostate cancer. I've mentioned all of these drugs during the course of this lecture, and this is really kind of where we put them in the sequence and in the big picture of this disease, both before and after chemotherapy, after androgen deprivation therapy, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's become a very complicated entity to treat. The biology remains fascinating. The patients remain wonderful. And it becomes and remains a true privilege to be able to not only talk to you tonight about all the developments in this disease, but it's a real privilege and an honor to be able to take care of men with this disease and to work to improve their outcomes. And so with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention and take any questions that you may have.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.